So her talk today is on the topic of Galileo's laughter, knowledge, play, and consequences. Please join me in welcoming Professor Kidman.
Thanks very much, and it's just a pleasure to be here and in such wonderful company as we explore and celebrate Galileo. So I, you know, for many years, as some of you know, have been very interested in the relationship between knowledge and play, and you know what play does for the generation of certain kinds of knowledge, how it intersects with certain approaches to the natural world, and more fundamentally, its significance to understanding key strands of 16th and 17th century science. So the talk I'm going to give today is in many ways the culmination of this project that has dealt more generally with the role of play in Renaissance natural history and in medicine and the way in which play creates certain categories and explores paradoxes of knowledge. And in the case of Galileo, it is not so much about how he understands nature, right, what he finds in nature, but it's how he approaches and presents his entire way of thinking about knowledge that I'd like to specifically explore in this talk. So, to Galileo's laughter. Shortly after Galileo's dialogue concerning the two chief world systems appeared in 1632, the controversial Dominican philosopher Tommaso Campanella wrote to congratulate the Florentine mathematician on creating what he called a great philosophical comedy. Right, this is Campanella's famous term for the dialogue. While admiring the way in which all three characters, the sincere Florentine Copernican Filippo Salviati, the dull-witted Aristotelian Simplicio, and the sharp-tongued Venetian arbiter Gianfrancesco Segredo played their parts, he reserved his highest praise for the character of Simplicio, writing that Simplicio was, as he put it, the laughingstock of this philosophical comedy, who at the same time shows the foolishness of his sect, the manner of speaking, the insecurity, the stubbornness, and whatnot. Clearly, we need not envy Plato. There was no doubt in Campanella's mind that Galileo had written the greatest satire of Aristotelian philosophy that he had ever read. Other readers also expressed pleasure in Galileo's complex use of irony, humor, and jokes to expose the foibles of geocentrism and many, many other things. Galileo's disciple, Benedetto Castelli, for example, delighted in telling him how his sketch of Simplicio provoked, as he put it, a good laugh. Galileo explicitly encouraged this interpretation of his dialogue by referring frequently to its comedic qualities in his correspondence. As he informed his Parisian friend, Elia Diodati, in September of 1629, the dialogue, he wrote, was a genre that permitted greater freedom, and this is his word, than a philosophical discourse. This license allowed him not only to equivocate about the truth, but also to digress frequently from the principal subject. So we're back to Galileo's digressions, right? This is a digressive approach to knowledge. Labeling one digression a comedy within a comedy, Galileo presented his dialogue as a series of never-ending jokes about the failed efforts of traditional philosophy to truly grasp the nature and meaning of the universe. At the same time, he tried to soften his message by reminding readers that his criticisms against the Aristotelians were all in jest. In the midst of the second day, for example, Galileo has Salviati inform Simplicio that, as he writes, I, who am undecided between these opinions, only act the part of Copernicus as a comedian. Through such mechanisms, Galileo sought to assuage his critics that Salviati's Copernicanism did not emanate from any strong conviction, but emerged out of a duty to fulfill a necessary role in his philosophical comedy. Segredo, more than Salviati, exemplified the pointed humor of Galileo's dialogue. Described by Salviati, again, these are of course Galileo's words, not the long-dead Salviati, as an acute and penetrating wit, Segredo is a Venetian who indulges in the pleasures of knowledge by being a master of the art of the joke, much in the manner of Castiglione's courtiers in the previous century, who sought to bring forth some hidden strain of folly in their assembly. Yet Segredo carefully distinguishes this kind of courtly laughter that we see in Castiglione's Book of the Courtier, one of the bestsellers, right, of this period, certainly a book Galileo knew, from the more penetrating and serious sort of philosophical rivalry he wished to generate when he reminded Salviati, and again, this is in the imagined, you know, dialogue, right, that Galileo constructs, that he is, as he puts it, at school and not at court. In the end, Segredo is not a courtier, but a Venetian patrician, a citizen of a republic who can speak freely. These comments serve to highlight the role of Segredo in Galileo's dialogue. Wit was not merely the window dressing of Galileo's famous and controversial scientific book, but an integral part of how the conversation was supposed to proceed. Segredo was not merely playing, but playing seriously, and I think this is the key point, to understand what it means to play seriously. In suggesting that Galileo's laughter was essential to his conception of knowledge, I want to provoke a discussion about how we assess the ingredients of an epistemology. In his recent edition of documents related to Galileo's trial, for example, Maurice Finocchiaro, which is who is certainly, you know, the person who more than anybody since Stillman Drake has made available all of the Galileo documentations, and no one has studied the language of them more carefully in many respects as a result. But, you know, if you look at the recent edition that just came out, and this lovely short introduction, right, that he's done for it, in this Maurice says, what he does is he classifies Galileo's penchant for satire. It's not a primary focal point. So, I mean, I offer this as an example. It's not a criticism of, you know, his wonderful work. But he says, the satire, he says, belongs to the psychological and personality traits of Galileo rather than being an intellectual characteristic of his work. And I have absolutely no reason to take issue. In fact, I agree with many, many things that he says in his expert analysis of the religious and scientific issues that are at stake in Galileo's trial. But I want to use this point, right, that he separates out the satire as an example of how we cleave the different parts of Galileo's work to raise the following question, which is central to this talk. How can something so central to Galileo's writing and thinking be considered epiphenomenal? Simply can't, in my opinion. My goal instead is to bring the question of Galileo's laughter into our analysis of his philosophy of knowledge, to consider it integral, not simply to how he presented his ideas, but to what he thought and why. Reading Galileo's dialogue attentively, we can see the development of what I have described elsewhere as a seriocomic account of the origins of modern science. Galileo's astronomy, as he chooses to present it in this culminating work, began and ended with laughter. Drawing upon his own youthful encounter with the idea of heliocentrism, Galileo recalled the skepticism that Copernicus's ideas still engendered in the late 16th century. And he, of course, captures this once again in the way he fictionalizes Segredo's encounter with these ideas. Segredo's encounter with Copernicus is, in its own way, a joke. In the second day of the dialogue, Segredo describes his decision to skip the lectures of a German astronomer in Padua on heliocentrism because everyone was laughing at this foolish idea. Curiosity, however, compels him to inquire further. He discovers one member of the audience who confessed to him, as Segredo puts it, that the matter was not entirely ridiculous. Now the joke has been turned on its head. What seemed comic is now serious and should be taken seriously. By the third day, Segredo has become a staunch critic of anything written, as he says, in derision of Copernicus. The truer heliocentrism seems to be, the less appropriate it is to laugh at this idea. In his well-known letter written to Kepler in August of 1597, Galileo himself derided what he called the infinite number of fools who laugh at and reject heliocentrism as one of the reasons he had hesitated to publish anything on this subject. He returned repeatedly to this theme in his later writings, finally citing the biblical source. Stultorum infinitus est numerus, right? The number of fools is infinite, Ecclesiastes 1:15. In the Assayer, he cites this in the Assayer in 1623. For many early modern readers, this passage would have immediately brought to mind one of the most influential and profound books of the 16th century, and also one of the most controversial, the work of the Dutch humanist Desiderius Erasmus, In Praise of Folly. And it was quite possibly an Erasmian reading of this biblical aphorism that, when combined with better evidence, finally emboldened Galileo to argue in favor of Copernicanism. Like his fictional Segredo, Galileo's own conversion was powerful and absolute. By 1613, he was ready to respond in print to his Aristotelian critics, who joked about the implausibility of the new celestial phenomena that the telescope had revealed. "It is about time for us to jest right back at them," declared Galileo in his letters on sunspots. And he proceeded to do this in many different ways right up until his trial in 1633. Returning to the dialogue itself, the less Segredo laughs at heliocentrism, right, as the dialogue proceeds, the more he scorns other cosmological alternatives. His personality is fundamentally comic. We are left with the sense that only a certain sense of decorum about the behavior proper to the kind of conversation, and his affectionate indulgence, right, that he insists on repeatedly towards Simplicio, keep him from rolling on the floor of his Venetian palace in mirthful, bellyaching laughter at the absurdities, the sheer absurdities of Aristotelian philosophy. As Segredo says to Simplicio early in the second day, assuring him that he is no butt of the joke, "I merely smile, but believe me, I am hardly able to keep from laughing," right? So these are these two levels. I merely smile, this is the restraint. But beneath that, of course, what we really want to do is laugh. Segredo basically in this moment presents a cultural principle, not a philosophical one. The cultural principle, as is stated in etiquette books like Giovanni della Casa's Galateo, which Galileo has in his library, it's one of the best sellers, again, of this period, says mockery is a form of bad manners, right? Don't do that, right? So he says, okay, I'm going to not do that, but I'm going to tell you I'd like to, you know? So behind the facade, right, of the refined Venetian patrician lies the heart of what we should aptly describe certainly as a laughing philosopher, a Democritus waiting in the wings to emerge center stage. Of course, even Segredo cannot help at times laughing loudly and sarcastically at the follies of peripatetic natural philosophers. The issues at stake are simply too important to him to restrain his laughter when discussing matters of astronomy, rather than, in the case of the above passage that I just mentioned, the origins of the nerves in the brain or the heart, right? It's a medical debate. You know, we can be polite. But when it comes to astronomy, perhaps not. Galileo has Segredo call all astronomers who share his sense of humor to assist him in demolishing arguments in favor of geocentrism. After Simplicio argues that the Earth cannot move because it lacks joints, Segredo imagines Kepler, one of the few references to Kepler, wittily responding that the Earth is indeed like an animal because it perpetually rolls about in the heavens to refresh itself. Salviati, who appreciates Segredo's jokes without always condoning them, he has more decorum than the Venetian, reproves his friend for openly making fun of Simplicio, saying, "Segredo, you are too caustic and sarcastic. Let us put aside all joking, for we are dealing with serious matters." Fundamentally, right, laughter is a kind of liberation, right? It removes the restraints, facilitates alternatives. Segredo immediately responds in such a way to underscore the utter gravity of the subject, saying, "Excuse me, Salviati, but to me what I have just said is not so far from relevant as perhaps you might make it out to be." This is one of these moments where we see Segredo insisting on the value of playing seriously. This crucial idea that laughter is a source of profound truths informs the structure of Galileo's dialogue and many of his earlier writings, especially the dialogue of Cecco di Ronchiti, published in 1605, and of course the Assayer of 1623. Despite Galileo's reassurances, no one was convinced in 1632 that Galileo had written a philosophical comedy in which the truth was irrelevant. Or perhaps we should say that virtually no educated reader of the dialogue would have imagined this kind of comedy to be equivocal about truth. Ever since Plato, the dialogue had been the best means of exploring crucial subjects of importance with humor and irony, pointedly guiding the reader to a particular view without forcing them to a conclusion. In the hands of ancient satirists, such as Lucian, it became a bawdy and irreverent means of criticizing the foibles of those in power. With the revival of satirical dialogue in the Renaissance, and I want to see Galileo as one of the great readers of that world of satirical dialogue, works like Aretino's bawdy caricatures of 16th century Rome, Erasmus's colloquies about the follies of the church and humanity, the playwright, the Paduan playwright Ruzzante's earthy comedy satirizing the Paduan elite, Castiglione and Tasso's witty and refined dialogues that satirized court culture. These are just to name a few. Galileo, in other words, had a rich way of models to draw upon in creating a work that spoke the truth in disguise. This, by the way, was also increasingly dangerous terrain filled with works that were considered impious by the Roman Catholic Church as of the mid-16th century and were placed on the index of prohibited books in large quantities once the Roman index was created in 1559. So we certainly need to see Galileo as belonging to these early generations of readers who grow up assessing the role of prohibited books in their intellectual lives. And what these books offer them. And there's been an enormous amount of work done in recent years on the question of prohibited books. And, you know, I can sort of talk about that later if people, you know, want me to say more about that. But I just want to say that this understanding about readership now, the readership of prohibited works and the way in which it works into the reading and writing lives of people in early modern Italy, we have a much more sophisticated understanding. We really can now see Galileo as a certain kind of reader of this work in a way that I think was implicit but hard to make explicit until this kind of real hardcore research in the archive of the Congregation of the Index and the archives of the Roman Inquisition could be done once they were open to lay researchers as of 1998. The witty and ironic tone of Galileo's dialogue played no small role in his trial and condemnation. As the Jesuit Melchior Inkoffer concluded in his lengthy report of April 13, 1633 to the Holy Office, Galileo, as Inkoffer put it, would not have ridiculed Aristotle and his followers so insolently if he had not been convinced that they were in error, right? So what really, Inkoffer is one of the people who reads, offers his reading, what is the point of all this, right? He also felt that Galileo's ridicule of the received interpretation of those scriptural passages which describe the movements of the heavens indicated a complete disrespect for his adversaries. Inkoffer wrote that Galileo had treated them, and again here I'm quoting him, as if they were small-minded, half-witted, and almost idiotic, right? The Stultorum. The irony of Galileo's letter to the discerning reader that precedes the dialogue, where Galileo presents himself as a defender of the Roman Catholic Church against northern, presumably Protestant critics, also struck Inkoffer as empty and frivolous. Finally, Inkoffer expressed his dislike of one of Galileo's best jokes towards the end of the dialogue, that geocentrists were not human because they were animals without reason. I mean, this is the quality of the kind of humor we see. And any of you in the room who've read the dialogue know this very well. All this is to say that what delighted people like Tommaso Campanella and Benedetto Castelli greatly displeased readers in Rome, such as Inkoffer. But all of them, and this is the general point, all of them were responding to the style and effect, to the very nature of Galileo's dialogue as one of the fundamental issues. Galileo had indeed created a serio-comic masterpiece. Unfortunately, he did so at a moment when few inside the Vatican were prepared to laugh with Galileo at those astronomers and natural philosophers who denied the possibility of heliocentrism. Playing seriously with the systems of the world earned him influential enemies, as well as friends. Urban VIII's famous comment to the Tuscan ambassador Niccolini that even our Galilei had dared to enter where he should not have, into the most serious and dangerous subjects which could be stirred up at this time, right, this is his retrospective comment, starkly points out the inappropriateness of Galileo's approach to hypothesizing about systems of the world in 1632. Astronomy was no longer, at least for that particular audience, a cosmic game, a realm of infinite possibilities where hypotheses might be spun out ad infinitum, but a subject in which the truth mattered, on both sides, for that matter. Galileo agreed with this view, but he did so for scientific rather than theological reasons. He philosophized, as he put it, joking and in sport. And he uses this phrase, joking and in sport, in his famously flawed explanation of the tides in day four as the culminating proof of heliocentrism. So again, I mean, at every key moment, this way of presenting what it is you do is always there. Because, of course, he sees no alternative. Nor I would like to argue, does he really want an alternative? I think this fits the way he wishes to. This in many ways, is part of what frustrates readers like Descartes, I think, about Galileo. Descartes certainly does not do this. Increasingly, Galileo's conception of the sources of truth diverged dramatically from the ones upheld by the Roman Catholic Church. Dialogic play provided him with the necessary space to explore and declare alternative truths. Now, I want here to return to the fundamental questions of this inquiry. Why did Galileo persistently and repeatedly present science as a kind of philosophical comedy? What can this tell us about the principles underlying his natural philosophy? And to what extent was humor not only an epistemology, but part of his heresy? As I've said before, laughter fundamentally, in this Erasmian sense, is a kind of freedom. And a lot of the work that's been done on Erasmianism in Italy in this period has not only demonstrated the importance of the Venetian Republic, of the Padua, right, of Galileo's most influential years up to 1610, but also in the development of Erasmian community that then gets increasingly put under pressure and ultimately put underground as the century wears on. But what we also see that there is a whole sort of world of, you know, pedagogy that very strongly associates freedom, right, with Erasmus's concept of free will. And you know, so this is one of the discussions that's going on, particularly in this world that Galileo enters once he moves to Padua after his very short stay in Pisa, so in this critical period of his career. So what I want to do in the rest of the talk is to give you a sort of sense about how we see these questions about the role of humor and laughter and satire evolving across Galileo's works. From the beginning of his career, Galileo used humor and irony not only to present himself as a new kind of philosopher, neither a peripatetic nor a pedant, but to encourage others to imagine knowledge as an open-ended game, to some degree in the tradition of the 15th century philosopher Cusanus. Whoever wants to understand the truth of something has to use his fantasy, play with ideas, and find the keys to the puzzle, wrote the young Galileo in an early satire of academic life entitled Against Wearing Togas, or Against Wearing the Robe, Contributare la Toga, which was a poem composed during his tenure as mathematics professor at the University of Pisa, not even at Padua, from 1589 to 92, he's at Pisa. As Anne Reynolds has argued, this particular poem reflects Galileo's great admiration for the satirical poetry of the early 16th century Tuscan writer Francesco Berni. Reading Berni was one of the ways in which Galileo was exposed to an Erasmian and Rabelaisian worldview. I mean, again, the question is, how are these things coming into this particular context? This is one of the ways it's arriving in Tuscany, is through the philosophical poetry of Francesco Berni. Who offered an ironic approach to knowledge that eschewed formalities and convention in favor of paradoxes, which stripped away all illusions in search of a better truth. In his best-selling Praise of Folly, written in 1509 and first published in 1511, the humanist Erasmus argued that the mind thrived on three things in particular: laughter, jokes, and wit. He passionately believed that play and laughter were attributes of the good Christian. The Roman Catholic Church responded to this idea by putting all of his books on the index as of 1559. Responding to his own critics in his career, Erasmus queried, citing Horace, "What's to stop a man who can laugh from speaking the truth?" In the tradition of Erasmus, Galileo believed that the play of ideas was an essential part of the human condition, as was the ability to laugh at the follies of the world. They both shared a certain indebtedness to ancient writers, namely Plato and Lucian, who had argued for the importance of comedy. "Without comic things," wrote Plato, "we cannot even learn serious things." Comedy was not merely an attitude, but a way of being and knowing, one that Galileo cultivated to the fullest possible extent during those crucial decades when he debated astronomy, physics, and cosmology with various opponents. We must certainly see Galileo as an important reader of Erasmus's Praise of Folly, applying Erasmus's general critique of his world to the question of how to interpret nature. Given the prohibitions on reading Erasmus, and I want you to keep in mind that among the charges leveled against Galileo's older contemporary, Giordano Bruno, by the Neapolitan Inquisition in 1576, one of the key charges leveled against him was the reading of Erasmus's books, as I recall, in the latrine, actually. You know, was how it was said in the trial documents. You know, and so given the prohibitions about reading Erasmus, you know, and Erasmus is strongly associated with what the Italians call the Luterani. This is this generic word for the Protestants, right? I mean, the strong association. It seems ironic when you read Erasmus, given his debates with Luther, that he would be conflated with him. But in fact, in the critique of Erasmus in Italy, he's strongly conflated with the fears about Lutheranism. This is, in other words, very dangerous ground, right? And I want to bring this out to understand how an early modern reader would have reacted to the style and recognized what it was, right? Either with pleasure or perhaps with horror, you know? And again, we can sort of talk about why are people more horrified about this in 1633 versus in 1623 or some other earlier moment where, you know, the axe does not fully fall or perhaps not fall at all. But, this brings us into other issues that I'm not focusing on in this particular talk. But again, I want you to kind of think about this idea that Venice is a space in which to do these kinds of things, right? You know, the famous freedoms of the Venetian Republic included a very strong set of traditions about comedy and satire and this kind of Erasmian approach to knowledge. Prior to using these talents to openly defend heliocentrism, Galileo seems to have experimented with the idea of philosophical comedy as a means of attacking Aristotelians on other grounds. The anonymous dialogue of Cecco di Ronchiti attributed to Galileo is an early and pointed example of this use of comedy. Written as an attack on the Paduan philosopher Antonio Lorenzini, who had denied the possibility of the 1604 Nova after it had been described all over Europe, it appeared when Galileo was a young mathematics professor in the same city. Filled with earthy humor in the manner of the Paduan playwright Ruzzante, and written, in fact, in Pavano dialect, the dialogue of Cecco di Ronchiti put the truth in the mouth of peasants, making philosophers seem utterly absurd. So in this dialogue, two peasants, Matteo and Natale, poke endless fun at the intellectual pretensions of the Paduan Aristotelians, who deny novas and comets and other things like that. They laugh themselves silly over Lorenzini's diagram of stellar parallax, and they joke that the best place to read his pamphlet denying the appearance of new stars is Shades of Bruno at the bottom of the latrine. At a crucial point in the conversation, Natale remarks, "If this new star was in the sky, all natural philosophy would be a joke." But this, of course, is the point. Traditional accounts of the heavens have been rendered ridiculous by new theories and observations. The center could no longer hold, and the only way to take Lorenzini's pamphlet seriously was to read it, as Galileo reminded his own readers, as a carnival book. The dialogue of Cecco di Ronchiti is actually literally a carnival book. At the conclusion of the dialogue, Matteo and Natale make this point explicit by telling Lorenzini that he would have to rush to publish any response. And they say, well, why? Because of the timing of when their pamphlet has come out. And they say, and this is one of the final words, it's nearly Lent, right? The time for this discussion is over. It's nearly Lent. Once Carnival was over, refuting the new truths of the heavens would become an impossibility. And needless to say, comedy and Carnival were two of the great threats that the Tridentine Catholic Church actively combated and censored as well. So again, all of these themes that are under discussion and critique in this period are all there in the style of writing. One of the many reasons to consider Galileo at least a partial author of this anonymous dialogue concerns his fascination with the plays of Ruzzante. Later in life, friends described his skill in imitating Ruzzante's own simulation of peasant dialect of the Paduan countryside. His Venetian friend Segredo at one point, and this is in a letter of March 15th, 1615, I'm sorry I didn't do a PowerPoint for this, but it's just a short quote. Segredo writes in March of 1615 to Galileo, and he says, he has some reading advice, and he says, "Continue reading Berni et Ruzzante, and for now leave aside Aristotle and Archimedes." Now, there are a lot of ways to take that particular line, but I think it's very important to imagine him talking about those four authors in one phrase, right? Berni, Ruzzante, Aristotle, Archimedes. I think right there we have an interesting image of a worldview and a way of thinking about reading and knowledge that is perhaps a little unfamiliar to many of us, but I think was quite familiar to Galileo and his contemporaries. Galileo owned the 1565 edition of Ruzzante's plays, not, this is I think quite important, not the expurgated versions, the post-index versions of 1598 or 1617, after the original had, yes, of course, been placed on the index. He owned the uncensored version, right? Does he have a license for it? I'd have to ask one of my students who's doing a lot of work on this right now, actually, looking at the, you know, reading licenses for physicians and philosophers in this period. I don't believe he does, though. While he may not have been able to write a philosophical dialogue in Paduan dialect entirely on his own in 1604, right, this has been some point of debate ever since Dylan Drake did the modern, you know, edition of it, Galileo certainly had the ability and interest to draft this kind of philosophical comedy in the decade following his confession to Kepler of his Copernican sympathies. Irony allowed Galileo to emerge from the shadows and declare his allegiances to this new account of nature. As Galileo completed his first, less well-known dialogue attacking traditional natural philosophy, he must surely have considered the fate of a far more controversial master of philosophical dialogue, the ex-Dominican heretic Giordano Bruno. Bruno's controversial publications of the mid-1580s not only proclaimed in a very, very complicated way the truth of Copernican astronomy, but also did so with devastating wit and humor. Ironically, both Galileo and Bruno competed for the same mathematics chair in Padua, though it seems unlikely that the university would have ever appointed such a controversial figure. Shortly after Galileo's arrival in Padua in 1592, Bruno was arrested by the Venetian Inquisition and subsequently sent to Rome, where he would linger in prison for 7 years until his death in Campo dei Fiori. Styling himself a reincarnation of Democritus, the ancient laughing philosopher, and Momus, the god of laughter, Bruno was one of the great comic authors of the late Renaissance. He proclaimed his Ash Wednesday Supper, his Copernican dialogue of 1584, so humorous that, as Bruno wrote, it would make monkeys split their sides with laughter. A fan of the ancient satirist Lucian and a great reader of Erasmus, as was Kepler, who admires Bruno much more than Galileo. Galileo never overtly admires Bruno. Not possible. Bruno's wild, heretical laughter reverberated across the end of the 16th century, and it became a point of contention in his trial. In his trial documents, at many points, people talk about his laughing. They talk about what they call una gran risata, right, his great laugh. I mean, you know, and literally he is laughing in the trial, so it's not simply an account of something on paper. It's an account of how he is. We need to contrast that to the declaration of the French theologian Pierre Nicole later in the century that Jesus never laughed. The spiritual status of and philosophical resonance of laughter was not a trivial issue in the 17th century. So did Galileo read Bruno? This has been one of the interesting questions for many years, you know, and one that's not easy to resolve. But I side with Hilary Gatti on this particular issue, who has argued that it seems impossible to believe that he did not. The relationship, however, is a subtle one, since there were good reasons for Galileo not to advertise Bruno as a source of inspiration, or in any way have his own dialogue about Copernicanism associated with one written a half century earlier by somebody who had died so badly. To understand Galileo's relationship to Bruno, we need to read between the lines. Envisioning the evolution of philosophical comedy between the 1580s and the 1630s. For instance, in his Ash Wednesday Supper, after Bruno presents the reasons why he believes, or Bruno, I should say, his alter ego, the Nolan, as he calls himself, because he's from Nola, after he presents why he thinks heliocentrism is true, one of the Oxford pedants laughs at his propositions, and then a more sympathetic participant responds, "Is not the truth of what the Nolan said proven by the fact that you laughed at it so much?" But as the Nolan completes his explanation of the new cosmology, the culmination of which is Bruno's argument in favor of the infinity of worlds and the plurality of souls, the pedant ceases to laugh. The passage was surely the model for Galileo's own account of his conversion to Copernicanism as a moment in which you cease to laugh. Here and elsewhere, we can see Galileo reworking Bruno's best lines, taming his wild heretical laughter into something more orthodox and hopefully productive. Describing the Ash Wednesday Supper in another philosophical dialogue entitled Cause, Principle, and Unity, also from 1584, Bruno presented it as the epitome of serio-comic writing, mixing grave and serious words, he wrote, moral and natural, ignoble and noble, philosophical and comic. He additionally presented this approach to knowledge as a form of veiled speech, when he declared in his expulsion of the triumphant beast, again from the 1580s, those who do not dare to talk do speak in a kind of jest. Campanella's description of Galileo's own dialogue now appears in a different light, since Campanella certainly read Bruno and was invoking Bruno's own description of his work in his letter to Galileo. This was surely one of the many reasons why Galileo did not accept Campanella's kind offer to defend him before the Roman Inquisition. In a passage in Cause, Principle, and Unity, Bruno has one of his characters declare, "The world is such that we play Democritus. The outcome is that, since one is a fool in the eyes of the other, we are all fools." Galileo, too, envisioned himself as a laughing philosopher, and as Christoph Luthi has shown in an interesting article on the legacy of Democritus, this construction of the image of the laughing philosopher enjoyed a revival in the generations after Erasmus that were also a great age of skepticism. Galileo envisioned himself as a laughing philosopher. I think I just said that part. Sorry about that. In a letter to Kepler, written in August of 1610, regarding criticisms of the discoveries he had made with the telescope, Galileo wrote, "What is to be done now? Shall we follow Democritus or Heraclitus?" Each in his own way chose the former. Kepler's conversation with the sidereal messenger that he published in 1610 was, as he told his readers, deliberately humorous. Responding to the rumor that Galileo had mocked the Medici by naming imaginary satellites after them, in other words, the moons of Jupiter, Kepler not only defended the veracity of his colleague's discoveries, but also presented Galileo as an heir to Democritus and Bruno, right? This is Kepler's reading of Galileo. Who does Kepler want Galileo to be? To some degree, he may also have been inspired by Galileo to joke back, as he announced he would now do in his letters on sunspots of 1613. That same year, in which all of this conversation is beginning to evolve, a rumor circulated in Florence among the Dominicans of the convent of San Marco that the Galileans, perhaps even Galileo himself, believed, as they put it, that God is sensuous, that he laughs, that he cries. Well, unsubstantiated when it was investigated, it suggests the way in which Galileo became associated with an Erasmian heresy. Despite these murmurings against him, Galileo more openly staked out his position in the next few years. In 1615, when opposition to heliocentrism was mounting, he sought to demonstrate why it was neither ridiculous nor paradoxical. In his unpublished Considerations on the Copernican Opinion, he did so with a joke, envisioning how ridiculous it would be, as he wrote, to argue that God spelled shadow, right? This is Galileo's own show. He makes a joke about God. He traveled to Rome and openly ridiculed his opponents in public debates, as we know very well. 2 months later, Copernicus's On the Revolutions would be placed on the index, right? So this is this moment of 1615-16. Galileo is making jokes about God. There are concerns about whether or not Galileans think that God laughs. And there are other concerns, of course, that are not the subject of this talk, right, that we know very well from this story. The consultant's report to the Holy Office in February of 1616 cast a different light on what was worth laughing at when they declared, instead of heliocentrism, this proposition is foolish and absurd in philosophy and formally heretical. Throughout the 1610s and 20s, Galileo refined what it meant to be a Democrat and natural philosopher. The Essayer, for example, successfully combined different strands of Democritus' posthumous reputation as an atomist, an anti-Aristotelian, and the quintessential laughing philosopher. By this point in time, Galileo had fully absorbed Renaissance humanist view of Democritus as a positive role model for making laughter the source of the most profound insights into the human spirit. The great success of the comic style of the Essayer, filled with jokes about Aristotelians and Jesuits, who simply did not get this approach to knowledge, invited readers to take the journey along what the 16th century poet, who also was read by Galileo, Boiardo, called simply the river of laughter. The success of the Essayer emboldened Galileo to see philosophical comedy as his best avenue for defending heliocentrism during the papacy of Urban VIII. The idea of the dialogue was sanctioned, once again, by Erasmus, who said, "Put everything in the mouth of a comic character so that it will amuse and divert and not be offensive." But Erasmus was now on the index and had been unable to live up to this precept, and Galileo fared even worse. There are many levels, in other words, as I just conclude now, that Galileo's philosophical comedy that culminates with his dialogue in 1632 recalled a long and interesting and rich set of prohibited books and real and alleged heresies by 16th century authors. The choice of style helps us to understand the position that Galileo took in his writings when he cultivated a distinct way of presenting his ideas. He had evidently reflected on many different forms of comedy, poetic, theatrical, philosophical, and theological, in developing his own approach to knowledge. In conclusion, I'd like to present Galileo as possibly the best example of what Johann Huizinga called, at the beginning of the last century, Homo Ludens, the best one since Erasmus, who of course is the centerpiece of Huizinga's work on Homo Ludens. He truly believed in the idea of playing seriously as a means of disseminating ideas to the widest possible audience under the most difficult and delicate of circumstances. Thank you very much.